I don't know. I guess I'm an immigrant, so I'm not interesting.
My name is David Berman. I am an undergrad at New York University. I'm very much interested in transnational labor movements and more broadly transnational solidarity movements.
I'm Adrian Marshall. I'm
a student. I'm Pac. I'm a member of the Plaid Affiliate Society and an immigrant. Thank you, Brett, for reminding me. Yeah, I'm here because I guess I'm curious about what we said with the left perspective on immigration.
I'm Brett. I helped organize the event, and I'm, you know, I'm a self-professed immigration Philistine, which is partially the reason why I wanted to participate in organizing this. It's education for myself. I was also interested in the relationship between labor and immigration as well, specifically. I'm also
My name's Kurt. I just moved to New York City about 4 months ago right now, I guess. You're talking about Central America. I guess it's an interesting subject. I actually hitchhiked through Central America up and down, and then hitchhiked a bunch in the States, so kind of a similar experience. But kind of informal traveling, you run across a lot of people who are immigrating. So, you know, I was hitching rides with people who are in the process of immigrating to United States, or at least Mexico, and also, I guess, at the border between Guatemala and Mexico, you know, the border crossing, and within sight, you'll see people on tubes, like, you know, paddling across the river, so it's not like it's subtle, it's just very present in everybody's lives there, so I guess that makes it, that by itself is interesting to me, but God, immigration is everywhere these days, whether it's in Europe with kind of far-right movements who are reacting against immigrants, or in the United States, kind of a similar situation. Everywhere you go, immigration is front and center.
Then, do you want to introduce yourself? We're just kind of going around saying who we are, how we're interested in the topic.
Sure, my name's Nadia. I'm interested in immigration, or
yeah, anything you'd like. And I'm Jeremy. I guess I'll introduce myself. I'm going to be sort of leading the conversation with David here this evening. I'm a member of Platypus, helped to organize this. I read your book several years ago, in fact, met you, I think, and have your book autographed. And I'm very interested in topics especially around immigration and labor organizing and sort of immigration and the left as a whole more generally. So I'm going to give a 2-second spiel about Platypus and then we can get started. So Platypus is an organization primarily on student campuses. We have chapters in Chicago, New York, Toronto, Frankfurt, Germany, Kingston, in Boston, and Princeton, I think that's all of them. And we organize events on the left today, past, and future. This is our New York website here on the board. We have a free monthly broadsheet that we publish. That's the Platypus Review, which is sort of articles from many different positions on the left in order to encourage ideological discussion and debate on the left that we feel sometimes is sorely missing. So I'm going to send around this interest list thing. Please put your name down if you'd like to find more out about the events. We have an event coming up next week, which is a flyer for a teach-in on Adorno and the autonomy of art. And we also are going to have a film screening at the end of the semester, Godard's La Chinoise, film screening, discussion, snack, etc. So we have pretty regular events at NYU, also at Hunter and the New School, weekly coffee breaks, which are on some flyers over there and in the papers. So I think that's my spiel. And I guess we can start if you're ready. So I have some questions that I prepared, that some of us together actually prepared for David before the fact, and so I'll sometimes be looking back at these as a guide, some, and generally having the conversation between the two of us. And then we'll do that for about 30 to 40 minutes, I think, and then we'll open it up for questions, comments, thoughts. So, let's begin by touching on some topics covered in your book, The Politics of Immigration, which I'll give your plug here.
I actually have some for sale.
There we go, after the event. So, can you give a telescoped history of the relationship between the left and immigration in U.S. history? How has immigration been involved in left politics? Have immigrants, how have the left and the labor movement reacted to, been involved in, been led by, opposed, or rejected immigration and immigrants?
Okay.
Large question.
I won't actually, we'll focus on the telescope part. Of course, to a large extent, this country was peopled by immigrants, especially after 1800. So to a large extent, anything in U.S. history is about immigrants. But probably, the immigration from Europe probably did have a larger component of leftists than was already here. Which is not to say people who were, especially, you know, in the second half of the 19th century when people from Italy, Eastern Europe, and so on started coming, socialism was very much on people's minds then in Europe, and a lot of it came here through those people. Which is not to say that, you know, people who were WASPs, like my family, or African Americans, or Irish people who came earlier, couldn't come up with the idea on their own. It's just, you know, there was already this socialist tradition and anarchist tradition in Europe. Probably one of the things, there are various reasons why, as you probably know, the U.S. originally cut off immigration from China and then from all of Asia, pretty much by 1910. And then in 1924, they cut off all immigration, almost, from Europe, except from the northern, whiter part of Europe, but, you know, not the Eastern Europe and Southern Europe they didn't want. One of the things that was on people's minds, of course, this is the period of the Red Scare, and people had this image in their minds of Emma Goldman and Italian anarchists carrying bombs and so on. Most of which was not true, but there's an element of truth in it. So, there was very much, I mean, one thing you have to remember is there were times, I think, in the Socialist Party, there were sections of the Socialist Party on the East Coast where they'd be told, really, we're in the United States, you should try having some materials in English. And they would say, why? You know, we have materials in Yiddish and German and Russian, why would we have it in English? So that's the level at which, you know, immigration was connected with the left. Now, when immigration was cut off in 1924, the older people, you know, there was still this sense that immigrants, you know, like everybody, you know, your favorite old CPers and so on, you know, came from immigrant families, sure. But new immigrants didn't come in. And for the same reason that the general population started being, you know, getting the idea that immigration was abnormal, the left did too. The left pretty much lost any sense of how immigration works. And I really think, I'm not exaggerating, when I started working just like in the early 90s, I ran into the most amazing statements from people who really were quite progressive. And I remember one thing, a bunch of Central America solidarity groups were going to do an event, and Haitian groups too. We were going to do an event in 1995, I think. And we wanted to have an immigration component. And somebody who was very, you know, hard left person said, Well, I don't think we should do that because the topic's sort of controversial. And like, comrade, controversial. We're supposed to avoid that? But I mean, that's really where it is, and we kept on running into that. I think to a large extent, the left in this country started getting interested in immigration again, above all after 2006, when suddenly there was this huge demonstration, you know, which came, if you weren't involved in the movement, it really came out of the blue. And so people were interested in it, some for good reasons, and some, you know, sheer opportunism. Like, wow, here's a movement here, we have to relate to it. And I think, without wanting to offend anybody, I think a lot of people on the left, what they think their role is, whatever liberals say, they'll say it loud. So liberals say, oh, these poor immigrants, they're being oppressed. We feel sorry for them. You know, which is very much an attitude of, you know, these are dark-skinned people who are victims who need our help. You know, the white man's burden, that sort of thing. And I think a lot of the leftist attitude towards it is like that. What I think is, and what the idea that people had 100 years ago when there was an earlier wave of immigration, when people on the left really did, to a large extent, get, I mean, there was anti-immigrant feeling then too, but was that, number one, the immigrants who are coming here are being forced here. They're not coming here because they want to come here. They come here because they're being forced out by global capitalism. And by the way, if you read, the only thing I know by where Marx directly addresses this is, I guess, the 1870 letter to Meyer and Vogt, where he talks about the Irish immigration. That's exactly what he says. The Irish forced out by English capital into England. Once they're in England, then they're super exploited and they're used as a way of dividing the working class, setting the English against the Irish workers and vice versa. When the immigrants come here, they're part of our working class. They are workers just like anybody else. And that's the way we should think about it. Instead of thinking, well, how can we help these poor people? We should be thinking, they are part of the class. Their interests are the same as our interests.
So I guess my question, to sort of follow up on that, is how have you seen, since 2006 especially, sort of means of organizing immigrants and try ways of attempting to articulate that with the labor movement, things like worker centers, other things have become sort of really at the forefront of a lot of like excitement about sort of, my God, there's something living on the left. And I guess my question is sort of, what do you see as the sort of positive developments that have occurred that have allowed this movement to thrive? And has it been sufficiently articulated with the rest of what a leftist movement might look like?
Okay, in the first place, of course, people noticed after 2006. One of the things that was so funny to me about 2006 was this guy, Cirilo Garcia. And he was working with the Unite, briefly had a workers' center, and then closed it down in the late 90s. And this was, and I'm sure he wasn't the only one, there must have been a lot of people with this idea. This is what he wanted. He wanted to have a big May Day where nobody, you know, all the immigrants didn't go to work. And he started organizing lunchtime rallies on May Day in the Garment Center, which shows how quickly things have moved. There isn't a Garment Center at all anymore. There was still a small Garment Center, say, in 1997. And, you know, we all thought, Cirilo is great, but he's crazy. You know, this will never happen. Obviously, people like him were doing that over and over again, and they really got the idea into people. And then when, in 2006, immigrants were really mad because of the Sensenbrenner Brenner Bill, they actually did it. Which doesn't mean that they're going to do it every year, which is one of the fallacies of leftist organizing. What happened this year will happen again next year. No, it's not true. But this sort of thing has gone on, and in good ways and bad ways. One thing that happened was the unions realized, they did realize that they weren't getting anywhere. They were just losing members. And a lot of the immigrants coming come from a background which is much more militant than what we... The militant tradition in this country has pretty much been forgotten. You know, like, maybe your grandparents can tell you about it, but they probably won't, because after the McCarthy era, everybody clammed up. But people are coming here from, you know, like, in Central America, there's this tradition when you get laid off. You know that the owner's going to not pay you the severance pay they're supposed to pay, and so on. So you go sit in the factory so they can't get the machinery out without paying. When this happened in Chicago with the public windows, everybody said, oh my God, what happened? These people sat in at the factory. Well, you know, many of them came from Central America. It's just traditional. Although, I mean, there were other things involved too. So the unions recognize this, and partly the unions had this tradition of saying, of just fitting into the normal mold of, we don't want these people here because they're going to compete for jobs, blah, 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 and because they speak a foreign language and they're hard to organize. Now they discover they're actually not hard to organize. Like, there was one thing a few years ago where this factory, this kosher meat factory in Brooklyn, the Latino workers got together. There were also Polish workers. Here's where we some of the problems with the Indian movement. The Latino workers and Polish workers couldn't even talk to each other. But at any rate, the Latino workers got together and they formed a union. They said, we formed a union now, but who's going to affiliate with this? And they couldn't find, for the longest time, they couldn't find a union that wanted them. And then finally, I guess the United Food and Commercial Workers, one of the locals, 1500 maybe, said, oh my God, this is good, we'll take them. But, you know, there's a whole process like that. And, I mean, you know, once again, the way to look at it is you actually have people who are trying to push this thing forward. But it's also hard to organize because they're scattered around generally in small shops, and because there's a very high turnover among immigrants. And then, of course, we get into the legal situation, which is the immigrants who come here are basically forced to be undocumented. They are illegal workers, right? That's the term everybody uses. And it has a reality, because you technically have labor rights, you technically have constitutional rights, but in reality you don't, because they can pick you up and throw you in jail for, you know, months and months, and then they deport you. So that's always this threat that you have against you. That makes organizing difficult.
So do you think, those structural limitations, the fact that immigrants often work in like super exploited sectors, very heavily subcontracted, and they face immense legal barriers towards being represented, they're easily sort of shipped out. What does that mean vis-a-vis the prospects for large-scale immigrant organizing sort of happening, for immigration to be sort of the vanguard of some sort of returned leftist movement here in the U.S.? Are these structural barriers sort of just really deep, such that one can imagine hopefully a better labor movement where immigration is not, you know, it's not actively anti-immigrant, but at the same time maybe say to a left that often imagines that like this is the front runner now of where the left is going, that because of certain kinds of structural limitations that might not be the case?
No, I think the idea that some people are naturally the vanguard, I think that's something we shouldn't stress too much. No, it's not necessarily true. I do want to say about the structural limitations. Somebody from Unite who went on to be, what is it now? What is the AFL-CIO thing? The Solidarity Centers. Like I think he's in charge of Solidarity Centers in the Caribbean or something. Like he told me 15 years ago. You know, it's very difficult to organize people in, you know, little shops. You know, like in fact, it's impossible. Like, did you know your union comes out of organizing little shops? You know about the uprising of the 20,000? He said, no. You know, he's like, you heard of the Triangle Fire, factory fire? I mean, you know, come on. But no, he actually had. That's the way the garment workers got organized, in these tiny shops, by saying, we're going to have an industry-wide contract, which, of course, these AFL unions didn't want to do. But they were sort of forced by the immigrant workers to do it. True, the immigrant workers then didn't have the illegality, but they had all the other things. You know, they were in the garment shops. There were women. They were Jewish and Italian. You know, like they had all this discrimination. They didn't speak English, so you know they still organized. So it can be done, but you can't just sit and wait for people to do things. What I'm interested in is the other side of it. It's the people who are not immigrants, who totally don't get how the system works. I think that's where we have to concentrate. The immigrants are going to organize themselves, or they're not going to organize themselves. The unions are going to, the unions have gotten more helpful now. You know, they don't, I mean, the unions supported employer sanctions in 1986 to a large extent. And now they say they're against employer sanctions. Do people know what employer sanctions are? Well, this is the thing when you get a job, you have to fill out, you know, you have to show proof that you have documents to work, that you're a citizen or you have permanent residence or so on. And this was passed in 1986 as part of a compromise. The immigrants get an amnesty, right? The undocumented immigrants were able to apply and had a chance of getting a legal residency. But in exchange, the anti-immigrant people got the employer sanctions, which was presented in the form of the employers will get fined if they hire undocumented workers. So that will stop them from hiring the workers, and then the immigrants won't come because there won't be jobs available. Anybody with a brain, anybody with a brain could see, no, that's not what's going to happen. There was this huge debt crisis in Central, you know, the war going on in Central America. There's the debt crisis in Mexico. People are not coming here because they say, oh, there's nice jobs in the United States. They're coming because their standard of living had this terrible drop, or because, you know, their families are being hauled away by death squads and murder. So they're going to come, but what's going to happen if there's these sanctions on top of it? There's this thing that makes it illegal for you to work. What's going to happen is your salary is going to go down. Your rights are going to go down. It's going to be easier for the boss to exploit you. And this is something I think we pointed this out in the book. The whole time while they were trying to get this legislation passed in 1986, if you read the mainstream media, I don't think you found one person who mentioned this obvious fact. As soon as it was passed, the New York Times ran an article where they interviewed Mexican economists who said, oh, you know what's going to happen with this? It's not going to stop immigration, it's going to lower wage rates. Well, that is exactly what happened. So when people say it's an unintentional effect, it's not unintentional. I mean, for a lot of people in Congress who are not too bright, they probably really thought they were accomplishing what they said they were accomplishing. But smarter people knew that that wasn't going to happen. They knew that it was going to drive down wages. And it did. And, you know, it's very hard to, it's not easy to get this stuff. Most of it's not even online anywhere. You have to go to that library on 34th Street and get the Labor Department's reports. But yeah, undocumented workers were making about twice as much. The differential was half as much before the employer sanctions went into effect as after they went into effect. In other words, undocumented workers, like in 1985, were making about 10% less than documented workers with their same job skills, English proficiency, and so on. After, like by 1990, it was 20% less. So if you're a boss, what are you going to do? You have two workers who come to work. It's, you know, installing firewall. You don't need to speak English to install a firewall. One of them is going to work for 15-20% less than the other one. Who are you going to hire? You know, especially if the person presents some sort of papers to you, you don't look at it too carefully. So that's what employer sanctions are. And the unions actually supported this.
Why do you think the union supported it?
Because they thought it was a compromise with the ruling. I mean, it was just a typical union compromise. They thought this would be a good compromise. And some of them actually thought, it'll cut down the immigration, it'll cut down competition for jobs with our members. But I don't know. The union people I know are actually quite bright, so I really should interview some people and say, did you really believe that? Because I don't know why they did it. I honestly don't. But by 1999, you know, the AFL-CIO passed a thing saying, no, we're against employer sanctions. Now, there are people trying to push them to take that back. So that's something you can should pay attention to, and we should fight.
People within the unions or
within
the government?
The unions, yeah. Especially the building trades. You know, the more conservative unions are pushing it. Mm-hmm. And, of course, to get immigration reform, they keep on saying, you're going to have to make compromises with the business community. And the business community, the business, you know, what the business community actually want to stay there against this stuff, but to have guest worker programs. And that way, you'll legally bring in people that you can super exploit. And you don't have to go through the hassle of getting fake papers and so on. So,
I mean, do you think it's because of this compromise orientation that largely some of the deeper goals of the immigration movement have seemed to, you know, I mean, so there was the big hope, right, that the DREAM Act would get passed under Obama, and that seems to really have been scuttled. And obviously, as you mentioned yourself, you know, a huge rise like in 2006 has been less and less reproduced over the past few years. Do you think that's because of this kind of compromise strategy, or are there other reasons why these initiatives have not seemed to pan out?
You know, as I say, I think 2006 was a fluke, right? I don't think it's something that, I don't think there's been a descent from 2006. I think 2006 happened, and, you know, like, then you're sort of, things were at a higher level than they were before 2006, but it's still, you know, it's not the sort of thing that can be easily sustained. Leftists like the idea of going out and having a demonstration every year. If you're in a country where they give you a holiday on May 1st, and, which most countries do, then of course you'll go out and march, and then you'll go out and picnic. It's much harder when you have to take off. This year it's on Sunday. But if you have to give up your Sunday to go march, I don't know. But there was that was this moment in time. The immigrants were really hopeful in some ways, because there really was talk of some sort of legalization. At the same time, they were furious because of the Sensenbrenner bill, which is like really a slap in the face. You know, which even said the Sensenbrenner bill was even if you help an immigrant comes up and an undocumented immigrant asks you, you know, how do you get to Jamaica and say, oh, take the F train and the E train and say, oh no, you just helped an undocumented immigrant. You can do that. You know, they're threatening to arrest people picking up people dying of thirst in the desert. In fact, they have done that, without the symptoms. So there was this moment in time when this happened. On the other hand, I think most of the undocumented immigrants don't actually follow the developments on the political level as much as, you know, middle class leftists do. And they're not really aware of all these ins and outs. They really want a legalization. They desperately want a legalization, but I don't know if they follow all the compromises and so on. And then within the immigrant rights movement, you have the compromisers, the liberals, and you have the people who are much more hardline. Every time immigration reform has failed, the liberals always turn around and say, you people did this, you know, because you wouldn't compromise. Well, of course, the people in Congress didn't care at all what I thought. You know, they didn't say, hey, David, should we compromise? And I said, no, don't. And then they didn't pass immigration reform. That's crazy. You know, they didn't care at all. The way you go into negotiations, in fact, the way you go into negotiations, any labor negotiator knows this. You say, gee, I'd like to give in to you on this, but we got all those people out there. Look at them demonstrating. They're crazy people. I don't think I can control them. And the other side says, well, maybe we'll give you a little bit. Instead, the liberals in the immigrant rights movement always go to Congress and say, look, we've given up everything, so we're willing to accept exactly what you want, even with a guest worker program. And then the right wing says, no, we want more. Of course they do. I want to say about the DREAM Act, I interviewed, you know, when I don't know, does anybody here know any of the people like who did the hunger strike in June? You know, they camped out in front of Schumer's office and had this hunger strike. So I interviewed them. I might say the newspaper kept on saying all these undocumented immigrants. About half of them weren't. Some of them were native born, which actually is better, if anything. So they were really people showing, I mean, they were mostly Latinos. They were showing some of them were just showing solidarity, really starving themselves. You know? And they went for a week without food. A couple of them, one of the leaders, had to be hospitalized. But I asked them, I said, do you really like the DREAM Act? And they all said, no. We don't like it because there's a military component. We don't like it because it has this whole attitude of saying, well, we were brought here as little children, so we are innocent. We're not criminals like our parents who brought us here. I mean, that's, you know, that's something that's is designed, like so many things in this country, to set people against each other. To say, you, the innocent children, should be got against those illegals who illegally came in here, criminal, blah, blah, blah. So yeah, they didn't really like it very much, but they've been told over and over again, this is the only thing you can get. And they've been told that this is the only thing you can get since, I'd have forgotten, 2003 or something like that. Schumer and company were trying to get their immigration reform, which is limited legalization, big guest worker program, and more sanctions, not less. They said, no, we don't want you to do this. That's why they were having the hunger strike in front of Schumer's office. We want you to hold out for the package that we want. Then, when it became obvious that they would not get that package this year, and the elections were over, then Obama and all the Democrats said, oh my God, we want the Dream Act. When there was a possibility that it could have had an effect earlier in the year, they didn't. They said no. After it was too late, they said, oh, we want the Dream Act, so they could force the Republicans to vote against it. And then in 2012, and I'm not kidding, everybody who thinks about it politically can see this. And with no cost to themselves, then they stand up as the heroes for the Latino vote in 2 years. But many Latinos are perfectly aware, many immigrants, you know, who are naturalized and can vote, are perfectly aware that the Democrats didn't do anything for them all the time up until December when it was too late. So that's my feeling about the Dream Act.
Do you think that's going to mean something? I mean, is there any like discussion in this movement or more generally in sort of the labor world about some sort of politics independent of the Democratic Party? What would that mean? You know, or is it sort of, well, this is the only game in town, you know?
No, I think, you know, there just isn't a Democratic rights movement that has this idea of what, you know, like that has this universal idea. There's this Democratic part, and there's a part that's much more focused, and really much more focused on workplace issues, you know, much more focused on community issues right where they live, and they're not thinking about the political things. I want to say with the Dream Act students, my feeling about that was like, this is the classic case of, you know, I oppose your goals, but I support your tactics, because they've done this tremendous thing, in fact. And as I say, many of them didn't really like the Dream Act, and they were aware of what they're doing, because they looked at the gay rights movement, and they said, wow, that impresses people. We'll do the same thing. We'll come out. And they've done this thing over, like, going and sitting in Congress people's offices, right? And saying, come on and arrest us. Look, we're undocumented. We're undocumented, unafraid, unashamed. And they come in, they arrest them, and then they release them without turning them. With, you know, ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement, has a perfect opportunity to come deport them, but they won't, because the publicity would be bad. So, but this is something, you know, as for the gay rights movement, the coming out thing, and forces people to look at it and say, yeah, wait, most people in New York, you survey people in New York who are citizens and legal residents and say, do you know any undocumented people? And they say, no, I don't know any undocumented people. It's like, this is stupid. I mean, I work in offices, right? People in offices are undocumented if you get to know them, right? They have forged papers. Everybody knows undocumented people, aside from the fact, do you buy anything anywhere? Of course, you know, the person behind the counter is undocumented. But you don't know it, and so people can say, those illegals, and, you know, get this image of the other. But then it turns out the other isn't the other. The other is all these people you know. It's Manuel who, you know, gets you your flowers at the florist shop, right? So that's a brilliant thing to do. And I think that is something that's, you know, powerful in the movement. And I think the labor organizing is another key. But labor organizing, you can't just say, let's have the immigrants do labor organizing. We all have to be doing labor organizing. I talk too much. Sorry. Well,
I mean, I'm interested in this, you know, you talked about sort of the fetishism of marches and the sort of like, wow, there's a big demonstration and people expecting that to be the everyday thing. So, I mean, obviously you're calling for sort of the larger work of organizing, a slower process, something that takes lots of time, it's, you know, and is much harder work and much less publicity focused, which in some ways is an interesting relation to the coming out strategy, which is very, very publicity focused, very focused on like middle class, public opinion, like they're going to see this, they're going to... But I did want to ask more generally if you feel the way in which labor organizing is happening currently, especially the phenomenon of worker centers, which, as I understand it, is one of the sort of central ways in which immigrant workers are being organized right now and are being sort of dealt with by the labor movement or by, you know, lawyers, liberals, et cetera, whether these are sort of adequate to the tasks of ultimately really improving the lives of immigrants, making a politic possible that would help them out. I mean, I can think sort of along two lines, sorry, long question, but I can think along sort of two lines with this. One being that often worker centers focus on exactly sort of making high-profile middle-class opinion turn towards helping out illegal immigrants or focusing on intervention of lawyers, other sort of more trained professional types, rather than sort of structural power exerted by immigrants themselves. And two, that worker centers are often organized along ethnic lines. And so I wonder whether you think these, as organizational tools, are adequate to the kind of slow work of organizing immigration and getting it to be part of a larger labor movement that you're calling for.
Well, I think labor organizing, the form of labor organizing isn't like the biggest problem with it. The biggest problem with it is, you know, like, I can come out and say, well, I'm sort of a Luxembourgist on this. You know, labor organizing is the labor of Sisyphus. You roll the rock up the hill and then roll it back down. You need to organize this. You need to organize labor, like, if nothing else, because that's the only way people can defend their lives. You know, that's, I mean, not absolutely the only way, but in terms of salary and working conditions and so on, you have to be organized. And which you can see that this country became less and less organized. You see how wages go down. Now our pensions are gone and so on. But at the same time, when you do organizing, whether it's through unions or workers' centers, at some point you're going to have to compromise. And, you know, like, I know, if you know Wobbly history, Wobblies used to say, oh, the trouble with unions is they sign contracts. And then the Wobblies would get a union or a local organized, and they had to sign a contract. Like, what do we do with that? Now, if you think, you know, okay, that was 100 years ago. I have friends, I have friends from Haitians, actually started off while they were exiled here, organizing in Markham County. And they're like anarcho-syndicalists, and that was their idea too. They weren't very successful here, but when they got back to Haiti, you know, around 1999, they got their first local organizer. And they had to sign a contract. They were like, wait a second, they objected in principle to signing a contract, but they actually had to do it. And they actually lost control of that local, and the workers threw them out because they hadn't done a very good job with the contract. They actually, their people got in the most recent election again. But, you know, they thought that really it was the form. The form of unions was bad, but where they have unions now in Haiti, it's the same form as like AFL unions, honestly. Except, I think, they still have real leftist politics. They really believe in the whole class fighting instead of just protecting the local shop. But however you do it, whether it's a workers' center or your regular union, you always have that danger. Have to compromise, there's no way around it, and that has all the dangers of corrupting the leaders, of, you know, just the problems of compromising and losing the fighting spirit. Worker centers, I think where they work, I mean, some people just totally believe in it, and some of them, I'm afraid they believe in it because they're very ethnically centered, and they don't want to organize where people are not in their limited group, which is unfortunate. But I think where they really work well is when they work with each other and they work with unions. And that does happen sometimes. Now, in 1999, I think another crazy person, Jerry Dominguez, is now a union person of some sort in California, but he set up what was basically a little workers' center, where he said, we're going to organize the workers at Greengrocers. So he tried it this way and that way, didn't get anywhere. And then he ended up talking to Ernesto Jorge from 169, which basically no longer exists. Ernesto Jorge was a Chilean unionist who had been tortured, and, you know, like a solid leftist. And he said, we'll support you, just bring them into our union. And so they proceeded to go with, and for various reasons UNITE, which doesn't necessarily always support things like this, UNITE looked the other way while NSW was setting up this whole thing. So before long, we had, you know, like picket lines in front of a whole bunch, like at some point there were like 5 different greengrocer stores in the Lower East Side. We had picket lines. Now, very middle class neighborhood, yuppies moving in and so on, but also a neighborhood with a lot of leftists and leftist traditions and liberals and so on. So we're out there, and so we were appealing to middle class people. People, I just never forgot the woman who said, "But I have to go here. It's the only place I can get a baguette." I'm like, "For the sake of the working class, can you go without a baguette for a few days?" And said, "No, I can't." They're okay. But and it worked. These little greengrocer shops, which was too small to organize and so on, they actually signed contracts and so on. Then the whole thing fell apart because Agnieszka died of cancer, because, you know, there are a whole bunch of things. And because there's high turnover, it's hard to maintain a union in these things. You really have to be committed to it. But one of the results of this was the Central Labor Council here, which was still not very good, but the Central Labor Council, which was busily ignoring this thing, finally on January 1st, 2000, Stephen Greenhouse had an article about the victory of the greengrocers in the New York Times. I think it was January 1st. And I think the AFL, the Labor Central Labor Council looked at it, and, you know, in fairness, Ed Ott, I'm sure, was pointing this out to them, looked at it and said, "My God, this worked." And they suddenly got interested in immigrant rights. So it had an effect. And I think that sort of work, it can be done, it can be done again, it should be done a lot. But to make it work, we have to get the idea across to people that immigrant workers, that when their wages go down, and this is the crucial thing that nobody's allowed to say, when their wages go down, that lowers the floor for everybody, right? It's the same question as with the minimum wage. And so when you say, you know, when you're regular, I like to say Mr. Block, you know, like it's in the old Wally cartoons, Mr. Block says, "These people are illegal, they don't speak English," et cetera, et cetera. Say, "You know what, Mr. Block? You're getting less money because of your goddamn racism." And, you know, sometimes it can be confrontational. A lot of people, put in a plug here, Jane and I, what we really like to do is not things where I drone on and on like this, where she drones on and on. We like to have dialogues where everybody contributes. And, you know, like, two of the best ones were at Suffolk County Community College, which is right there. It's like, I've forgotten, I'm old, I forget names. What are the names of those towns? Like where Lucetta was killed. Like it's a couple of miles away from the college. The where the two Mexicans were almost killed in 2000. That's a few miles away. In fact, that township borders on the college. So we went and, you know, talked to two different classmates. We did larger ones too, but we also had a chance to have these, you know, smaller dialogues with two classes there on two different years. And it's just amazing because a lot of the people started off saying the bigoted things that the media say, and some of them were trying to write around and say, "But actually, that's not my experience," which was interesting. And other people turned out, you know, after being quiet at first, then there was like one person was, remember, this is a community college, so virtually all of these people had regular jobs, right? One of them, you know, like, so he said, "I'm a construction worker, white parolee construction worker." And then about halfway through it, he said, "So what you're saying is what I would say to the guys at the site. Like, if you don't organize with them, it hurts you." And he's like, "Yeah, right. You know, people understand this, but they're not given the opportunity to think about it. People aren't talking about it." And I think that's really our failure. And you say, what should the left do? That's the sort of thing the left should be doing.
I mean, it's related, right, to this, to, you brought up Luxembourg, and for Luxembourg, right, a union in some ways is only as good as the ability, the left wing, the left politics that's achieving increased consciousness through the activity of the union, that actually is there with the union, telling people, though, look, here are all the limits of this union politics, here's the way in which this is a compromise, and instead there's a larger political goal your union, your activity as a worker might be part of, you know, socialism. And I wonder, I mean, some of the difference almost seems to me, you know, you're talking about the earlier moment in America, right, and in some ways it's this difference between, you know, in the earlier moment you have socialists that are organizing workers, attempting to organize immigrant workers as part of a large-scale working-class movement to overcome capitalism, where the vast majority of the sort of self-consciousness of, you know, say a young person who becomes politicized wants to work in immigrants, is that they're organizing a minority in order to increase that minority's, you know, sort of share in the American pie and minority rights, you know, and this is related to the ethnic organizing piece too, right, that Mexican Americans deserve rights too, Latinos right. generally, et cetera, et cetera. And that, I mean, in some ways that element of consciousness, of political consciousness of like a working class movement for a given political goal, which is not just a more tolerant society, but actually, you know, overcoming capitalism in some sense, like right. that is sort of very missing from the present scene. I wonder if you agree, or did I just make a statement rather than a question?
Well, I think it's not necessarily missing, but a lot of the immigrants themselves are, look, a lot of the Mexicans, you say, well, what do you think about the PRD? You know, they don't know anything about politics here, but they'll say, oh yeah, the PRD compromises too much. You know, like, I mean, really, some of them are very political, and a lot aren't. And of course, people who immigrate frequently, you know, they're more energetic and they're more likely to be political, interestingly enough, than people who stay. So it's not, there is that problem with the immigrant rights movement. There is a problem that when you're organizing on an ethnic basis, then of course that's dividing the working class against other parts of the working class. On the other hand, if, as I said, you know, here I have a friend who said, oh, immigration is too controversial. It's the same question as with, you know, African Americans and, you know, any other group, with women, with gays. If there's not a women's rights movement, if it's not a gay rights movement, you know what? Straight white men aren't going to do anything, you know, because you need to have the people who are directly impacted by saying, this is what's wrong, we have to do something about this. And so you need to have an immigrant movement, you need to have something that's directly focused on immigrants.
But on the other hand, I mean...
But it should be part of, you know...
Right, because I mean, like, the African-American movement is a good example, right? Because actually, I mean, generally wages for black workers are on average lower than they were pre-60s. So there's been, you know, great advancements in cultural respect and in civil rights and political rights for African Americans, but actually in terms of the labor movement, African Americans haven't really won out in any deep way.
That's true. But it's also, well, one of the things that's interesting about that is that the people frequently who are most directly impacted by competition over wages with undocumented immigrants are in fact African Americans and native-born Latinos. And so when you hear people say, well, they take our jobs, et cetera, et cetera, interestingly enough, the people who say that the most are the people that are least impacted by it. I would say everybody who's actually in the working class is impacted by it because it lowers wages a little bit. The people who are directly affected and lose, you know, 2 or 3% or maybe more are, in fact, you know, people at the bottom or who don't get jobs at all. But, you know, people, instead of working at construction sites, they end up going working at McDonald's because that's a place where they get worse wages, but, you know, they're not in competition with undocumented immigrants. When you talk to people, I mean, this is the experience we've had in dialogues, that over and over again, especially African Americans, but Latinos are a little different because frequently they have relatives who are undocumented, so they're more directly impacted by the immigration issue. But generally, African Americans will say, you know, we fought to be able to get into construction sites, and now that, you know, we've overcome to some extent the racism of the building trades unions. Because when I was young, like, if you went to a construction site, everybody was white. Absolutely. You know, actually, I saw some construction going on in the subway, which was a throwback to 40 years later. There was not a single person there. It was not male. It was a contract. It wasn't transit. It was a contractor. But they say, you know, we did all this to overcome the racism and get the jobs. And once we get this, now it's all non-union sites filled with immigrants. And so you say, you know, basically put out the class line and say, yeah, this is dividing the class against them, each other. And almost always they said right away, oh yeah, you know, like in the South, you know, like pitting the whites against the blacks and lowering everybody's wages, you know. Like, but African Americans actually have a better sense of this, of the question of how to deal with immigration, even though they're the ones who are directly impacted. They've really, you know, they've been the minority, right? They've had that experience. But they're also the people who suffer the most. They and native-born Latinos, the ones who suffer the most. Aside, after the immigrants, they're the ones who suffer the most from the exploitation of these immigrants.
I mean, I guess the last question I'll ask, and then we'll open it up generally. I mean, what forms of then sort of political consciousness work, sort of the kind of educational work you're talking about, have you seen examples of that really sort of working well, really contributing to the movement ahead? What would that look like? What ideas are the sort of most important that you think are worth getting across to people? What kind of political education gets people not to be nativists? Like, gets...
Well... Now, of course, with the Green Roses camp, as I said, it was from the Lower East, it was, you know, the East Village, Lower East Side. So you had an awful lot of, you know, people that were easy to deal with. But that was really good, because in terms of just what we're talking about, I like the dialogue model, and I want to encourage other people to do that. But this is another type of dialogue you have. You have a picket line, and you say, don't buy here. Of so-and-so. And you get people to discuss it. And, like, and before long, we actually had people say, well, but, you know, like, but don't unions, you know, like, stop jobs and lower their wages? And you say to people my age, and say, were real wages lower back when, you know, like, 20% of the population is unionized when you were young? And they're like, oh, no, wages have stagnated or gone down since then. Yes, thanks. You know, like, that's one thing that gets people talking. If you have a picket line, you have organizing going on, I think that's, you know, that's an important thing to know. And so I very much support that sort of model where you, another example of that, although this was something where the city, the Central Labor Council didn't do a very good job in this even, but the city was on top of it and the bosses were on top of it. But the Solidarity strike, if you know about that, that was 2 years ago. Without going into the whole story of it, that was very much a mixed workforce, like racially very diverse and mixture of native-born and immigrants. And they put up a tremendous fight. And initially they're like, well, we're going to go on strike and it's hopeless, we're going to lose our jobs. It is what happens. But initially they won the strike. At a certain point, they said, we're not getting anywhere. Why don't we go out to the local community in the Bronx? And they did. And immediately they got all the support from the local community. When, you know, like I was, we had informational picket lines. I wasn't actually involved in this, but I went to some things. There were informational picket lines on the Upper West Side, which again is liberal, you know, left liberal community. But like people were totally enthusiastic. There were all these stories of, I don't know, I mean, people I know weren't doing this. There were all these stories of supermarkets where Estella Adoro cookies were all crushed in their packaging. People were just coming and crushed them. There was, you know, like there could have been a tremendous movement around this. And, you know, like people on the left, well, I was at one of these picket lines and I was supposed to speak on something about Latin America and globalization and social forms, which I really don't know much about. But as you can see, I'm willing to talk about things I know nothing about. So I was on the picket line. I had to leave early because I was supposed to speak at the Brecht Forum about social forums. So I got there, and they were serving Stella Adoro cookies. I'm like, so they didn't know at the Brecht Forum that there was a that there had been a boycott going on for 9 months. Now, I'm not blaming them, you know, like it's our fault. We should all be pushing these things all the time. We should never let these things go by, and we should not be diverted from it. There's all these other things. Okay, you want to argue about whether, you know, about whether you support the military intervention in Libya? Okay, that's fine, you can do that, but don't be distracted from these day-to-day issues here.
Why don't we open it up to people if people have questions? Comments.
I'm interested in what you think of kind of larger demographic trends in the United States, what impact they might have on all the various struggles that you've noted. I don't know enough about specifics to ask specific questions, but I know that in the coming decades, for instance, Hispanics and largely people of Mexican and Central American descent will be the largest minority in the United States. And I'm just not sure what the significance of that is in terms of immigration and organizing.
By the way, since you were traveling to Central America, I have to tell you the story that my brother actually did anthropological work in Chiapas like in the 60s, and he goes back there and visits. Like one time, maybe 20 years ago, he was in San Cristobal, and in the market, in one of the marketplaces, where indigenous people sell. So there were all the different indigenous people selling stuff about the richoles, and tzapales, and tzotziles, and everybody selling all the different things. And Migración came in, and they grabbed two people and said, "You're undocumented, show us your papers, you know, like, where's your electoral card?" And they didn't have it, and they hauled them off so they could deport them to Guatemala. They were, I think they were Cholets from Chiapas. Meanwhile, right next to them were a bunch of, you know, people speaking, I forgot what it was, but, you know, like speaking Guatemalan language. The Migración people in Mexico didn't even know. Like, the simplest thing in the world would be, I visited there, I could at least tell the difference between Sotil and Sao Paulo and the other languages, you know. The immigration people couldn't even tell that, you know, it was just arbitrary. They got a certain number of arrests. I think it happens here, too. Citizens have been deported, right, from this country. Native-born citizens have been deported by, you know, they get their quota. On the demographics, the important thing about, now, I still haven't read this book, but there's a book that basically says, it's about how immigrants became white, and part of what it's saying is that the advantage that the European immigrants had is that when they came here, I mean, people actually talk about, you know, the Jewish race, the Slavic race, the Italian race. You know, they were an inferior race. After they'd gotten here for a while, they became white. You know, they could be assimilated into the white middle class and white working class. Skin color really does make a difference because basically, for instance, Puerto Ricans, who were encouraged to immigrate in the 40s and the 50s and who were U.S. citizens, they are still second-class citizens, right? They are the new immigrants are assimilated. I say, why don't they assimilate? They do assimilate, but they're assimilated into the, you know, the minority, the so-called minority. And, you know, like, they don't get the advantages of, you know, being second generation immigrants. So that's a really important thing. And, of course, they have this thing, if they live in Arizona, then they're constantly being grabbed by the police. To, you know, they have to prove that they're... People say, well, why, if you're illegal, why would you be scared of this thing? We'll say, well, if you're white and illegal, you're probably, you know, like a number of my friends from Europe, or historically, I think we all have papers now. But they were never scared because they spoke good English and they were white. Immigration was never going to pick them up. A friend of mine wanted to get a legal residence, and her lawyer said, "You sure you want to do this? Because it's a lot of trouble and expense, and you know, like, you're never going to get into trouble." You know, so there is that. In New York, it already happened. You know, Latinos are the biggest non-white minority group. Whites, of course, are the biggest minority. It hasn't actually changed things that much. You know, the basic structure of society is you have to have a bunch of lower classes that can be easily exploited. The immigrants, in some ways, the easiest to exploit for historical reasons. African Americans can be exploited, and so on. You know, it's just like, but yeah, there are real demographic changes too. You know, like there are cultural changes. Supposedly, my grandfather, who was a county prosecutor in North Carolina, and we'd have a little bit of wine every Sunday dinner, and he'd say in the 1920s, someday there'll be a black president. And everybody in the family would say, "Shh, George, don't let anybody ever hear you." hear that. And when I was told that story, I thought, I bet that's true, but not in my lifetime. Because, you know, I grew up in a period when, you know, if we went to visit the family in North Carolina, that was the 50s. There was open segregation. There were white-only water fountains and so on. And my great uncle, who was a professor of library studies, he was on a library board for African-American libraries. And he said it was just like an African-American library, the separate but equal libraries in North Carolina, would be one room in the back of a schoolhouse with 10 books, or maybe 5 books, secondhand, donated by the community. You know, so, I mean, there really are changes. But the structure of the society has not changed. And it's not going to change if the demographic group itself changes. I'm not an expert on demography.
Someone else have a question?
I do have to agree with you that the societal structure is going to change, because I come from an area of the country where Anglos are the minority. Still, you know, like they still hold, you know, most of the capital for any, you know, for anything, whether people social capital or you know, finance capital, they still run. I mean, that's still, you know, the driving force of my Texas border community. The question I have, though, is regarding what unifying message would you suggest to, you have a Hispanic population that's completely fragmented, whether it would be, you got white Cubans who are anti-Castro, you have newly arrived Mexicans who have different experiences in their political structure. You also have, I mean, to stretch it out, you have immigrants from across the world. Let's say you have Chinese immigrants who have an experience, with a communist so-called equal society. How would you address that population that does have experience with a leftist movement and society, but that has failed in every which way imaginable?
Yeah, you know, I really don't know. I've several friends who are former Yugoslavs,
yeah.
And they're now more tolerant of Tito's form of socialism because of what happened after Tito. But I mean, they'll still say it that way. That, you know, like, and you can't say worker control around them, workers control, because they think of workers control the way it was in Yugoslavia, which they said it was. You had to go to boring meetings where they talk about, you know, how to manage the furnace and the plant and so on. No, we're trying to talk about workers control where the workers actually have control. And they say, oh no, it's a hoax. You know, and I think it was a hoax. So I don't know. I really don't know what to do about that, except that I think with China, maybe the problem is less, it's going to become less obvious as China becomes less, you know, even less, doesn't even, I mean, I work as a computer programmer, like consulting for a number of companies, and all the textiles now are not necessarily made in China, but they go through China, and then China subcontracts them to Sri Lanka and so on. And one of the companies we work with is in fact purely, it's owned by a Chinese person. And boy, you can't get any sense now that, I mean, not that I've been to China, but you can't get any sense that China is any different from the United States. Like, Chinese yuppies are just like U.S. yuppies, and, you know, and I mean, you know, like people who live and work in China. So I'm not sure.
But this, I mean, it's interesting because I think it's a great question, because it's related to this, you know, what is the banner under which this fight is being fought, and why is it that sort of a minority rights banner is the one that's so much more palatable than, say, a renewed socialist banner? And some of it obviously has to be the, you know, negative perception, both on the part, you know, obviously Americans are knee-jerk anti-communists, many of them in deep ways. There's a long history of that, but even, you know, the failure of the left has deep ramifications, and the people who come here are often, sometimes, to escape, like, terrible regimes abroad, etc. Not that they find anything marvelous here, but sort of, you know, what would it mean for socialism to have actual political meaning again?
Well, I mean, for one thing, you could start with the critique of capitalism, which is not, you know, people used to act as though that was impossible. It's right in your face. You know?
But do you, I forget who was mentioned Europe at the beginning, but of course, you know, there are, like, in some ways, the critique of capitalism in a place like Europe is exactly that. Well, capital is about open borders, it's about open financial flows, we need increased national controls, you know, close the borders, get the state with a heavier hand to control capital, de-internationalize capital. You know, this is sort of like a right-wing response to capital's crisis, right?
Yeah, but I mean, there's also been a lot of... I mean, look at the cases like last fall in France and all these strikes against the pension reform.
Yeah.
And part of, of course, people were just fed up with Sarkozy. They went on strike that they hated him. But it turned out that a high of something like 60% of the population supported the strikes. But only like 49% were opposed to the pension reforms. And the same people who supported the strikes but were nebulous on the pension reforms, they totally supported, you know, like taking away the niqab from, you know, the 2,000 Muslim women in the damn country who actually wear it, you know, and who are, you know, violently, you know, racist against Muslims and Arabs, right? So it's a very complicated mixture, but there is this way that, you know, of course France has a tradition of this, but there is this way when people's consciousness changes when you take away their pensions. In this country, and this is something, I started asking people this because, you know, I just turned 65, so it's on my mind. They're like, do you know when you'll be eligible for Social Security? And people say, oh, when I'm 65. I say, no. I'm the very last people who get it at 65. It moves up to 66. Then it keeps on moving up. People don't even know that. People who are going to be affected by it in a few years don't know it. Right? So why don't we have fights against pension reform? Because people watch reality television instead of paying attention to what's going on. Except I have to admit, I didn't pay attention to that either. I didn't notice it. And people really don't know that in the United States, they raised the retirement age, you know, basically without telling anybody. But there's all this stuff that goes on like that. And there's so much we can do to get people to understand it. And people are thinking this way. You know, people are thinking about it. These policies, like the free trade pacts and so on, most people are against them, but they don't know why. And especially when NAFTA was being, you know, when they were pushing NAFTA through in the early 90s, the left and the labor movement actually made some effort, but basically the left let Pat Buchanan and people and Ross Perot take it over. They became the right-wing opposition. And above all, because we let them get this, this Dominican organizer came here a few years ago and he said, I've been going on talking about free trade pacts, you know, like in terms of capitalism, in terms of which affects the Dominican Republic. And everybody I talk to here thinks we want these free trade pacts. That's right. People here are told, well, the Mexicans want it, the Dominicans want it, the Central Americans want it. And where have we been? Because it's not true. You know, we haven't been getting this across and saying, no, no, they demonstrated against it. Yet. We've got to get out and get this and get the idea across about what's really happening with this. And this is something where you don't have to convince people. They're already against it. Like, well, as I said, I work in textiles. Everybody there is totally against these things. They watch their jobs, the plants. And there was some question on the thing about white workers in the South. And my question was, sure you don't mean white worker in the South? I don't know if there's any factory workers left in the South. Because all the places I deal with, they're warehousing things that are coming in from China. There's no, the factories are long since closed. So this is something where, you know, this is an easy thing we're really not, we haven't been doing. Another thing is when the immigration issue comes up, you know, when they laid out, if you follow Mexico at all, last, in 2009, the government closed down the electric company for central Mexico and overnight laid off 44,000 workers, planning to hire back just basically, because they've been militant and problematic. And, you know, some of them were feather bedding too, honestly, but never mind about that. Compared to other things that happened in Mexico, workers' feather bedding doesn't bother me. So, 44,000 people are laid off. Nobody here pays any attention to it. There's a couple of things in the Wall Street Journal saying, yeah, that showed those workers. All of them written by things who support, by people like Anastasio Grady or whatever her name is, who supports guest worker programs. Okay, the Mexican government, above all, wanted to get them, people to take severance packages so there wouldn't be any trouble. And they offered them a generous severance package and various things, including classes. Classes and various things for electricians, electrical work, computer skills, English. Wait a second, English? Why exactly does an electrician in Mexico City want to know English? They came right out and said, we're going to teach you English so you can immigrate to the United States because we threw you out of work here. And where were the people who said, the people who say, the Reconquista, the Mexican government is encouraging these people to come across the border and take the country away from us. Not a word. They didn't say a word because they support laying off workers. They hate workers. You know, they hate unions. They thought it was a great thing. But in fact, that was the sort of way you get the immigration. So people who don't want immigration, just one thing you can say, aside from pointing, you know, I mean, you really do have to confront the racism and you know, the way people are cutting off their noses despite their faces and so on, but you can also say, when you say you're against the undocumented immigration, why aren't you against the conditions that cause it? Did you know that NAFTA is what causes it, one of the things that causes it? Do you know that union busting in Mexico, which is supported by our government, those are the things that cause it? Do you know that if you supported workers in Mexico, you would cut down the rate of immigration? Do you know that in Mexico, there's a whole movement called the Right Not to Immigrate movement? Most Mexicans, you know, just last fall, a group of women from Tlaxcala came here and put on a pledge, which they stood up and said, our demand is no immigration. They don't want people to leave, especially across the border, you know, get killed in the desert. But, you know, I mean, there are all these possibilities, but we're, you know, we need to jump on them.
And what you're talking about is internationalism. I mean, there would have to be some sort of real organization between workers in Mexico and workers here and workers elsewhere that were constantly raising to consciousness the idea that capitalism here is capitalism there, is capitalism everywhere else.
But I'm saying there's real possibilities for that, and there's real things, you know, like they actually ask for support. And it's true that, you know, it is a good development that the USW and so on actually does send messages of support and even delegations to and money, for that matter, to the copper workers and the Cananeo strike and so on. Although, you know, the union there is sort of like a corrupt union, I might say. You're smiling. I mean, you know, like it's they're not exactly. One of the people came here and gave a talk at 1199 a few weeks ago, and they said, "What's your strategy?" And the strategy, well, we think the PRI, the former ruling party in Mexico, is going to win the elections in 2012, so we're negotiating with them. So they're going right back to the old strategy of the PRI, which privatized their mine and threw thousands of their workers out of, they're going to go back to, you know, negotiating with them. But you know, there are a lot of opportunities, but we really have to be dynamic and get out and, you know, say these things. But it's not hard. It's just like I was saying with the Suffolk County Community College students, you know. When you talk to people, you get much more of a response than when you don't.
And so, I mean, basically it's an insufficiency of people being talked to that's the reason why Americans can be so incredibly anti-immigrant in so many sectors of social life, that there is real support for these policies.
Well, to me, one of the things that I think is so interesting about what happened in Wisconsin is do people have any sense of if there is any sort of class consciousness, any sort of solidarity, anything like that in this country at all? Isn't that amazing? Does anybody understand the level of propaganda that we are confronted with? You know, I mean, if you get anything that's moderately liberal, you know, on NPR, you're surprised. The fact that occasionally the leftists on NPR, which, you know, is not Fox News, not what most people hear. I mean, that's amazing to you. This is an incredible propaganda machine. And yet there still are, to get back to this Greengrocers campaign, one of the things I loved was one day, Grace, one of the owners of the place we were picketing at, called the police because we were supposed to stay behind a certain line. And we cheated a little bit. Honestly, we did. We violated the agreement. She called the police. Two cops showed up. Big, burly, white guys with Long Island accents. You know, like your classic racist white cops. They got there and they talked to Grace for a couple of minutes. They came over and talked to us. And said, yeah, let me explain what this was about. You know, I said, this is mostly Mexican workers standing in the line. And they went back to Greece and said, we found a violation with this, we found a violation of that. And they started writing out tickets for her. Right? Now, other cops from that same precinct, by the way, you know, attacked Jerry Dominguez, the organizer, and beat him up once, you know. So, but I'm just saying, even, you know, these cops that you thought were going to be against you, because of all the, you know, all the things that would make them be against you, they actually recognize the idea of, you know, we're going to support the workers on strike.
I think another issue that kind of comes up with this is recognizing
so, like, the danger of the sort of media politics around, like, a single, you know, heart-rending issue that gets some action, but then sort of dissipates, and people feel good about themselves because they've done something.
Yeah, sure. And I mean, the issue, like you brought up, you know, people actually, you know, not knowing what's going on beyond that, you know.
Yeah, well, I think it's, in terms of inner advice, it's really important to say, and I do want to promote something else, so the Dignity Campaign, which the Nation magazine, for some reason, probably dying with Dignity Campaign, but it's the immediate issue with the Chipotle workers, but it's not, it's basically done by labor organizers, so, but just to keep a focus on, number one, the right to organize, the right to work, and that includes the right to legalization, and to say we don't support anything less than full legalization, and we totally do not support guest worker programs. And like 80% of the people in this country, if they understood anything, they would support that position, because that's to their benefit. The system we have now is to the benefit of the small minority at the top. It's not to the benefit of the rest. And the white racists who say, stop these illegal, blah, blah, blah. As I said before, they're cutting off their nose to spite their face. And, you know, like, you can say that to people, and, you know, the hardcore, you're never going to convert, but who cares, you know? I used to know somebody who was a white union organizer in the South in the 60s, and he said that, you know, like, there were the racists you couldn't do anything with. But among the white workers, there was always a, you know, sizable percentage that, even if they were still racist, they could say, but I'll unite with African Americans because it's my own benefit, you know? And, you know, and you can work on these things. And those people, now that he was organizing, you can, I mean, you know, he was in North Carolina. They voted for Obama. Obama carried North Carolina. It wasn't just on the basis of the African American vote in the state. There were a lot of white people voting. You know, so it actually does, the interest, your class interest thing, is a way of opening people's mind against racism, too.
And so the hope is that that kind of opening would lead towards a more general rise in a class politics that could articulate real opposition to capitalism, yeah. That this is sort of a way into that?
I think so. You know, by the way, one of the things that's interesting in Latin America is that people always used to say, well, you know, these are incredibly conservative societies, so you can't ever do anything about women's rights or maybe in the distant future. And gay rights, that's totally out. You can't even talk about that. And so what's the largest city in North America that recognizes same-sex marriage? Quick? Mexico City?
No, my
brother testifies for gay asylum cases from Mexico. In most of Mexico, like, if you got a good chance of being killed for being gay. I'm not saying it's like a paradise. But on the other hand, a lot of that is because people said, yes, it's conservative Catholic society and so on, but you know what? We on the left, we're actually going to say we support gay rights, we support abortion rights, and we're going to lose votes because we're going to do it anyway because it's right. Or for whatever reason they did it. They did do that. And you know what? It worked. You know? They've actually got a lot of support. And you know, when they passed, I guess, abortion rights in Mexico City, the cardinal got out there and said, every legislator who voted for this is going to be excommunicated. And the legislators said, one legislator was a very devout Catholic, was asked, what are you going to do? He said, what is excommunication? It's from the Middle Ages. I'll go to another parish. And aside from that, my priest would give me communion anyway, because he supports abortion rights. You know, you can turn people around. I mean, you know, there are hardcore racists and sexists and homophobes and so on, but most people are not hardcore. Even if they're on the surface, they're divided, you know? And there are things that, you know, it's like jujitsu, you know? There are things in people that you can use to shift them over.
We have one last question over here.
Within New York City, there are a lot of these community organizations based on very, very rarely seen any labor or political organizations interact with them, as opposed to, say, Bloomberg, who has a lot of outreach to these community groups, even so much as inviting them into Gracie Mansion for yearly immigration programs.
not that I really know. The labor unions have like, gotten a little better, but you know, they are conservative about these things. You know, they're conservative, and many of the ethnic-based groups are conservative too.
Yes.
You know, and so they're not going to want leftism. And yet, on the other hand, like some of the things, like you get these things that surprise you, like with the Green Losers campaign, the Korean Merchants Association or something like that. At some point, they said, because most of the green groceries were Korean owned, and this was a real problem too, because I just remember charities. I don't want to hear you say Koreanos, you say Atrales, you say, you know, like Jefes, you know, say something, but don't, you know, like, don't be racist about it. It's not because they're Korean, it's because they're exploiting it. Well, many of the Koreans exploiting people fled Korea in the 1980s because they were on the left. And a lot of them feel bad about doing some of the stuff they do here. I certainly had that experience. I mean, a friend of mine had that experience talking to some place where there's an immigration riot raid and there's still garment shops in the garment center. And you know, the owner came right out and said, "Look, I'm on the left too. You give me a Know Your Rights thing in Spanish, I'm going to pass it out to the workers. So the next time the immigration people come, we're going to throw them right back out." So interestingly enough, in the Green Voters campaign, a mixture of things. One is this is hurting business for the more conservative people, and some of the more liberal people were like, no, they supported, they wanted, they didn't mind having a union in the shop. They sort of liked unions, but they couldn't do it because the other ones didn't do it. So it was a way of forcing everybody to do it. And their you know, the Young Korean United, the leftist group, they were very much active in that. So they sort of become more conservative like that. The person I knew from there is now involved in my city council. No, he was involved in my city council person. But I mean, he's good
at that. I bring it up because there's an organization called Adhikar I work for. And they're
called what?
Adhikar. Uh-huh. They're very active and they were involved with the domestic workers.
Yes, right. Yes.
And because of them, this other organization called Green Town Society, which is involved in very identity-based, people are starting to agitate as why aren't we involved in politics and such? Because there's an interlap between membership. And I was just wondering if there's such
things like that. Yeah, no, I really don't. And you know, I have to say, in the past, for various reasons, I've really not been involved in the human rights movement. I don't know. I'm talking about actually really before 2001 because I got involved in an immigrant's case, which took up all my time for 2 years, and then I sort of lost track of things. But and of course, with the Domestic Workers United, what they did, which shows that you can do it, even affect the bourgeoisie and the politicians, they actually got this Bill of Rights passed. Now, for domestic workers, now the next thing is, and this isn't, you know, this is a good way to organize too, right? They need to get out and get the domestic workers to understand that, need to get the employers to understand that there are these rights. A number of the employers, you know, people who are employing domestics in New York, they actually, they would support the rights if you talk to them about it. You know, there's plenty of yuppies who actually are not monsters, but because of the, you know, they've just been in the situation where they could get the nannies and the home care attendants and so on for nothing and, you know.
Yeah. But of course, as we know in the history of labor rights legislation in the U.S., enforcement is 99% sometimes of the struggle.
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of the enforcement has to come from below. It always has to, you know, it's the same as with, what is it, how many ocean, I've forgotten. Jane talked to one of the ocean inspectors and somebody was killed at a construction site. 2000, and he told her how many inspectors he had from New York City. I forgot what it was, but it was just laughable.
Yeah.
You know. So nothing, you know, like you don't get any ocean protection unless you have people reporting it.
Okay, why don't we close there? Thank you, David.
Thank you.
If you'd like to make your pitch for your book, your wares, feel free.
Selling books for just $10.